Good morning, Your Honors. Tom Peters on behalf of the plaintiffs. This honorable court should reverse and remand the district court's summary judgment order for several reasons. First, when the government seizes private property from a citizen without a warrant and then intends to detain that property for some extended period of time, the citizen is entitled, the property owner is entitled, to a prompt due process hearing following that seizure.
Mr. Peters, is your primary argument here then an argument focusing on notice of the procedures for getting the property back or the lack of a hearing that you regard as satisfactory?
Both, Your Honor. I think we've raised both issues consistently throughout these proceedings. I don't think that either one is valued more than the other. The right to this hearing exists separate and apart from the notice, although notice would be a part of the hearing. When the government seizes private property without a warrant, there should then be notice that the property has been seized and notice of a time, date, and location of a hearing. The city concedes that with respect to the inventory money that is at issue in this case, no such notices are ever sent because no such prompt post-deprivation hearings are ever held.
But you've appended to your brief two inventory forms, and it appears to me from the record that this might not even be all the forms that are in use, because the district court made a comment that the narcotics form it was looking at didn't have certain information that this one does have. But this form that people get says notice to property owner or claimant, return to the police station, et cetera, et cetera. So why isn't that notice?
Well, because that does not entitle you to any kind of hearing. What that notice informs you to do is to go to the police station in search of the police officer in the hopes that the police officer will issue you a Form 54.
Well, it doesn't quite say that. It says return to the police station, give this copy to the desk officer, and then you'll get instructions. And I guess then your record shows that those instructions say that somebody's got to chase down the arresting
Precisely.
Officer.
And that's not a hearing. That would be, for example, Your Honor, I think similar to, I agree, not identical to, asking the police officer whether there was probable cause to arrest, asking the police officer whether he coerced a confession. It's not a hearing when you go and you beg the police officer to please sign a form and return it to me. So the notice in this case is not a notice of a hearing because, as the city concedes, they don't hold these kinds of hearings. They require the arrestee/property owner to either track down the police officer in the hopes of getting a signed Form 54 or in the alternative to seek out a Section 108 court order. Mm-hmm. That is a separate problem with respect to this because the Section 108 order that the city claims is an available remedy is really not an available remedy.
Yeah, I wasn't sure why that was the case, but maybe you can explain why, because it seems to me the Constitution doesn't really care how a state affords you a hearing, whether they call it an administrative hearing, whether they call it some other process by which you can put forward your argument that this, let's say in your instance, this property is not going to be needed for forfeiture, this property is not going to be needed for evidence, please give it back to me. Why isn't the 108 hearing enough?
Well, there's several reasons, Your Honor. First of all, the 108 hearing inverts the burdens of persuasion and proof. It switches it from the government. The government should bear the burden of initiating the proceeding, and the government should bear the burden of establishing its right to continue to retain the property. In a Section 108 proceeding, whenever it is held, which is another issue, the burden is on the property owner to initiate the proceeding and is on the property owner to secure the requested relief.
Why does the government have the burden of initiating? Why doesn't the property owner at least have to sort of step forward and say, I want my property back?
I think the property owner might have to step forward and say, here's my inventory receipt, I would like my property back. But to then go on and disprove all these other things is not the property owner's burden. That's the government's burden. I think that that's, for example, similar to the North Georgia Finishing Company versus DICAM case, where there was a garnishment of a bank account. And the Supreme Court specifically assigned the burdens of persuasion and proof to the creditor rather than the debtor. And in that case, at least, the creditor had a plausible claim to the money. In this case, There is no set of circumstances under which the city is entitled to this money. It either belongs to the arrestee or, pursuant to a different statute, it may have to be transferred to a pension fund. But never will the city be the owner of this money. That being the case, it is inappropriate to assign the burdens of persuasion and proof to the arrestee slash property owner.
So now, even if you're right about that, and we'll just sort of put that to one side, the city offered to give back the money that it took from Mr. Gates and Mr. Nelson. And so that leads us to the city's argument that whatever may be either lawful or not, your clients don't have live claims anymore.
Well,
at least not for restitution, since a restitutionary remedy, they argue, really only covers that which was taken.
I think there's several answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, it clearly has to be limited to restitution. It doesn't apply to declaratory or injunctive relief. It doesn't apply to nominal damages. It doesn't apply to compensatory damages. With respect to the restitution claim, I think that the court should adopt the policy that the Third Circuit has in the Weiss case, which indicates that once a class action complaint is filed, notifying the defendants, we're not here just for ourselves, we're here for the class, that in those circumstances the defendant can't just buy off the named plaintiffs without offering a dime to the class. And in this case, there's an even more compelling reason to uphold the standing of Nelson and Gates, even as to restitution, because the net effect of the city's offer was to leave them losers. They were going to come out behind.
No, I understand your math on that, but I think you're asking for us to take a step beyond that which the Supreme Court took in Garrity and Roper and some of the other cases that recognize uncertified classes and the interests of the at least the unnamed members of the class. Namely, we have said in some cases, relying on the Indianapolis against Jacobs decision, that if the putative named plaintiff's claim becomes moot before there's ever even a motion for class certification, then that person cannot continue to serve for the class. I mean, we don't have capable of repetition yet evading review here.
Your Honor, this court has clearly said that, but they haven't ruled.
Right.
You have not ruled out the option that I am suggesting. And I think that.
And just to be clear, you're suggesting what?
I'm suggesting
the unnamed members somehow who can continue?
No, I'm suggesting that when the offer to the plaintiffs, when first of all the case is filed as a class action, so
right?
That,
no, clearly you have that.
Okay.
You know, on behalf of.
Then the offer, in effect, without class certification, without dispersing the costs among the class members, is going to leave the plaintiffs net losers.
Because of the filing costs?
Because of the filing fees and related costs, which can be dispersed among the class members, provided they're given the opportunity to proceed as a class. I'm not saying it should be mandatory.
So this offer, in your view, would have had to have equaled the filing fee plus the $113, for example?
To moot their claim as to restitution, I think that's the very least, and that was not offered. And as a result, they are still in a position where they have a vested financial interest in proceeding with this case as a class action, leaving aside attorneys' fees and costs under the statute. Just as a class, they come out better. It is a fairer resolution of the case, for sure. I'm not suggesting that this must be a mandatory rule. It should be a discretionary rule. It should be left to the discretion of the district court. If the case is filed as a class action, if the plaintiffs are going to be net losers based on the restitution offer that was tendered, and if the plaintiffs are acting in a prompt manner, which is the standard that was applied in Weiss, and which is, I think, the standard that particularly Justice Rehnquist was suggesting in Roper, then these people should be allowed to proceed.
But, you know, it's an interesting view of restitution, because if the city had taken their car and then just gave the car back, you would assume that was restitution. That would have restored the parties to the status quo ante, right?
Yes.
For a physical thing. So why is it different with money?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question. I think that the difference is that with respect to the car, that's all you could get back, and you got the whole car. With respect to the money, you really didn't.
But you had filing fees, presumably, in the car case.
I understand that. And you know, perhaps my position should be, well, although I admit I hadn't thought of this precise question, and I'm sorry I didn't, that's not restitution either. That when such circumstances arise, if they don't tender the filing fees, they're not actually getting restitution, because my understanding of restitution, at least generally, is you end up the same as you started out. And that's not the case under either of those scenarios. So perhaps a better answer to your question would be that I think that the filing fees should be tendered along with the cost. If I could then return to the section, the inadequacy of the Section 108 remedy, with respect to that remedy, it is not only inadequate because it inverts the burdens of persuasion and proof, it's also an untimely remedy. The Section 108 remedy the city concedes cannot be invoked by in the criminal case until the end of the criminal case, because theoretically the money might be evidence. So that in effect is saying you don't get any kind of interim hearing, any kind of relief until the case itself is over, which might be months or years down the line. And that kind of delay doesn't satisfy the Matthews timeliness criteria for a prompt due process hearing shortly after the time of the seizure.
Is there any de minimis aspect to this? I mean, the amounts of money here are really not very large.
No, Your Honor. In these particular cases, the amounts of money are not large, but sometimes thousands of dollars are at stake. And in a sense, Your Honor, I think the smaller the amount of money, the more compelling the due process case is. Because if you have a small amount of money, and then you're asking the arrestee slash property owner to spend hours, perhaps days, trying to track down the arresting officer, or if you're saying you have to go and get your attorney to initiate these proceedings, that is putting too high a cost on the owner. So the lower the amount of money, the more compelling the argument is to return it. And in fact, the city and the county and the federal government return small and large amounts of money all the time in bail situations. For example, a person posts bail in a state case. At the end of the case, they just mail it back to the owner. In this case, the city says we're not going to seek forfeiture. Now, after the fact, they say that. If they're not going to seek forfeiture and it's not their money, why don't they just mail it back to the property owner? They don't do that. They make the property owner jump through all these hoops. They are cost ineffective. They induce people who are many times not sophisticated in the law to give up.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you that. I mean, I guess underneath your theory is the notion that the process is so hard that a certain number of people just never manage to get their money back, and this money just sits there in the city's coffers forever. Yes,
thousands of people.
Do we have any evidence about how much
is? The city submitted, as part of the summary judgment proceedings, summaries of the amounts of money that were involved and the number of people. The number of people involved, if you include the narcotics and the non-narcotics classes, runs into about 2,000 per year. So over the course of the scope of this class, it could be as many as 10,000 people. And it involves millions of dollars, none of which could ever, under any set of circumstances, belong to the city.
But yet, does this data show how much the city regards as, I'll say, forfeited? How much is...
Yes. The numbers...
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. The numbers I was giving you, their chart breaks down forfeited from non-forfeited money.
Okay.
And there is a column that indicates the amounts that they admit are involved. In addition to the defects of the inversion of the burden of proof and the fact that with respect to Section 108, not a timely remedy.
Could I go back to one question, though? I mean, the monies that you're talking about are the monies that are initially checked off as potentially going to be involved in either as evidence or as a possible forfeiture claim, right? Because we've got these various boxes. So why is it not correct to hang on to that money until the criminal case is over? And secondly, why would it not be a full remedy if a proper amount of interest was returned when the money was returned? I don't know what the, I mean, the city's letter said we're going to pay you interest, but they didn't tender it. I know that that's a little bit unclear, but why wouldn't interest be enough?
Well, with respect to the first part of Your Honor's question, if I understand it correctly, the offer was incomplete, as you've suggested. And with respect to the remedy itself, coming at the end of the case, that does not have to happen, because what happens with the money in this case is it's not retained in any form that could ever be used as evidence. The money is deposited either into bank account A or bank account B. Once the money is deposited into one of those accounts, it cannot be used as evidence. It has been commingled with whatever other money is in the banks. It is never used, and there is no evidence that it's ever used for anything. The money is just deposited in a bank account. The city has three options, it's true, on their inventory receipt, but the options are just names arbitrarily given to these. They have nothing to do with whether there is an investigation or whether it will be evidence.
So when you're saying the money isn't going to be used as evidence, once it's been deposited in the bank account, nobody's going to check it for fingerprints or to see if it has cocaine dust on it or
exactly
any of the
right.
rest of that.
And that happens, according to the evidence in this case, within a week of the seizure, often within the same day or the next day. So almost immediately after the money is seized, it's in a bank account. It's no longer going to be used as evidence. So the fact that the criminal case is going on does not mean that there's any need to keep this as evidence. Nonetheless, you can't get it back. So the right to return of the property should exist promptly after the seizure, not at the end of the criminal case, not when all possible forfeiture actions have eclipsed.
Why shouldn't one at least wait for resolution of possible forfeiture actions?
Well, you're required to under this system. I think that the thing to do would be to have a hearing at which the parties would be present. Maybe it's an administrative hearing. Doesn't have to be in front of a judge, but some kind of hearing. And they can explain, well, we think we're going to file for forfeiture for these reasons. At least then, in effect, in these cases, the numbers that we have, there never is a forfeiture proceeding filed.
Is this that much different from other police departments? Is home rule involved in this aspect of it?
Well, the city claims that it has a home rule at times. The city claims that it has a home rule right to retain this money, that in some point in time it might even become their money. We dispute that entirely. I'm not aware of any, it's not in the record, and all I can tell you is I'm not personally aware of any other police department who handles inventoried cash in this manner. It could be, I just don't know.
I'm trying to recall how in the federal agencies handle it, because there's some very large sums that get involved there in drug cases. Are you aware of that?
Yes. And there are in a federal case, there are, if it's not returned to you, you can file a motion under Rule 41D or E for return of the money. There are proceedings by which you can initiate a prompt return of the money. Not so under this system. And if I see I'm running well into my time here, but I would like to say a little bit more about the notice issue. I think with respect to the notice, the critical testimony before the court is testimony that came from Deputy Chief Dugan and Lieutenant Victor Mitgall. Between the two of these people, they have a half century of police experience. They were tendered as 30B6 witnesses, meaning they were speaking as representatives of the city. When they were asked, what do these forms mean? They didn't know. They admit this form does not tell you when or how to get a Form 54. They acknowledged in their deposition testimony that these forms do not tell you when or how to get a court order. And when asked what the official notification meant, they said, we don't know.
I'll give you 2 more minutes after for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you very much.
May it please the Court. The District Court properly granted summary judgment for the City on the plaintiff's due process claims and correctly dismissed plaintiff's restitution claims as moot. This morning I will confine my remarks to the due process claims and will rest on our brief with respect to restitution claims because plaintiff did not address those, our submission that their claims are moot. At the outset, the Court should not address plaintiff's prompt post-seizure hearing claim because it was not presented to the District Court.
I think they did. I mean, it seems to me they were, in fact, challenging the kinds of procedures that were made available. And, you know, I have to say, maybe starting with these inventory receipts, how many different types of receipts are there in this record? The District Court was obviously looking at a receipt that we're not looking at in terms of the ones appended to the plaintiff's briefs.
I believe there are different copies of the receipts that go to different. There's a citizen's copy. There's a court copy.
Well, the court makes this comment. There's no column of notice to property owner in the narcotics receipt. And so I looked at the narcotics receipt that's here, narcotics seizure to be deposited, et cetera. That's Mr. Nelson. And there is this column. So I'm concerned about how many forms it is we need to be looking at, just for starters.
Well, I believe that the forms that are appended to the plaintiff's opening brief are the forms that Mr. Nelson and Mr. Gates received.
Okay. Well, for some reason then, you know, maybe Judge Castillo was given the wrong form or something. He makes a comment that's incomprehensible in light of looking at these forms. Secondly, as our earlier opinion in this case on the class certification suggested, there's a lot of messiness in this record about even the quality of the notice. Forget about whether they were talking about the propriety of the hearing. It's very hard to see from this form what clear notice is given to recipients of the form about what to do to get their money back.
Well, I think the notice really covers three different things. One is alternative remedies for seeking return of property. Again, we're talking here about non-narcotics arrestees only.
Well, the Pollard notice is a different thing, yes.
Yes.
Okay, so on the non-narcotics people, I'm looking at this, and it says, return to the police station where your property was taken from you. Give this copy to the desk officer in charge for forms and instructions necessary for the return of your property. The record that we have before us shows that people are sent from one station to another station to another station. They get conflicting instructions. That doesn't tell you very much. And then there's this phrase that the plaintiffs focus on, upon official notification that inventory property is available for lease, and there's never any such thing.
Well, Your Honor, we actually believe that reading that official notification language in its entirety, it makes clear it's really, it addresses a separate question. It doesn't address how to reclaim property. It just says that once official notification is given, which the form makes clear, is either the Form 54 that you get from the police station.
The form does not make this clear. I mean, whatever else it may be, there's no page about Form 54s or 108 hearings or anything. It just says go to the desk officer, and then you suddenly reach the sentence upon official notification. Maybe it's clear to you, but people who haven't been to law school, I think, would have a, I mean, I don't see anything about what you're talking about here.
Well, every arrestee has a right to an attorney, to consult an attorney, and that's.
And I'm saying that's not going to do too much good. This says property release order, CPD 34.554, required. So you already have to be familiar with the jargon to know that CPD-34.554 is really a Form 54, and you have to know where to get it. You have to know you know, you have to know a lot of things that aren't spelled out in this order, on this form, I should say.
Well, if the arrestee returns to the district of arrest...
What if he's in the jail? How's he supposed to go strolling back into the district of arrest if he's sitting there in the Cook County Jail?
Well, then perhaps the alternative remedy of seeking an order from the criminal court in the criminal proceeding under Article 108, which is referenced in the...
So you agree that Form 54 is useless for the person. And this is a set of people who predictably are going to be in the jail for a period of time, right?
Well, plaintiffs certainly make that claim, but...
Well, sure. I mean, the police have arrested them. I mean, a lot of people wind up in jail after they've been arrested.
They could make bond. I mean, there's really no way of knowing how many...
Oh, please. I mean, there are a lot of people. I don't know if it's half or something, but a great number, a predictable number of people are not going to be able to simply go back to the police department.
And for them, perhaps the remedy is Article 108. Again, an alternative remedy to seeking a Form 54 by returning to the police station is the Article 108, which is referenced in the inventory receipt.
Where's Article 108 referenced?
Bottom right, part under arrestee information.
Oh, seizure with search warrant.
And without a warrant.
And without warrant, 108.2, 108.10. It doesn't say anything about it. It says arrestee information, seizure without search warrant, hyphen, Illinois Revised Statutes, Chapter 38, Section 108-2, and then there's a cite. Then it says, give this copy to arrestee. If not accepted, attach to copy 5. And then it just cites the statutes. It doesn't say this is a remedy for you. It doesn't say get your appointed lawyer to file a 108 action. It doesn't say anything.
That's
it
correct.
It cites the statute.
That's correct. And that's actually more than what the notices did in West Covina, which the Supreme Court found entirely acceptable.
But your opponent distinguishes West Covina on the grounds that there was no claim there that the instructions were opaque or misleading. Everybody knew what they were supposed to do. Or at least there was no claim otherwise. Courts don't adjudicate claims that aren't presented to them.
Correct. But I don't believe that they've shown that the notice here is misleading.
It doesn't say that this is a remedy. I mean, up at the top where it says property release orders, where this system that you concede is not useful for people in the jail is described, and then it doesn't tell you why they're telling you about the statute.
Well, again, that's more than was done in West Covina, and I'm not sure how that distinguishes the case. They say it's misleading, and I think they're mainly relying on the official notification language, but we think that in context that's clear. That means once you get a Form 54 or a court order, the clock starts ticking. You need to pick up your property.
Was there any evidence on the percentages of how many people just give their money to the city versus those that go back and pick it up?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of that, if there is that evidence in the record. I don't believe
so. Mr. Peters said that there is evidence of how much winds up getting forfeited of the amount that's seized.
That may be correct for both non-narcotics and narcotics arrestees.
Sure.
But I don't know that it shows
percentages
picked up.
Does it show percentages or just amounts?
I think just amounts.
But wouldn't you have also data about how much is seized?
I believe there is data.
So if you can do simple division, you know, you'd find out that half of it's forfeited or 10% of it's forfeited or 85% of it's forfeited or whatever the number is.
But we don't really know why it's forfeited.
People didn't want their money? Is that, I mean, that's just not a reasonable assumption. What would your explanation be for the forfeitures?
Well, a certain amount of money does go unclaimed.
Right, and why do you think it goes unclaimed?
It could be any number of reasons. Perhaps the arrestee doesn't want to be bothered with going through the process of retrieving relatively small amounts of cash.
Well, $113 in some people's worlds is a lot of money. Maybe in other people's worlds it's not.
Oh, I understand, but of course the amounts vary. There are lesser amounts also for class members, so it's really quite a range.
Could you walk through exactly what this 108 procedure does? Somebody files an action against the city under Section 108 saying, give my money back, or what do they do?
No, it would actually be filed. It is like a Rule 41E motion filed in the criminal
It's filed as a motion in the criminal proceeding.
It is in the criminal proceeding itself.
So the person has to have been arraigned, and there has to be a pending criminal proceeding. And then you go into the criminal court, and you file a 108-2 or a 108-10 motion. And what does that motion say?
The motion, I believe, would say the police seized this property. And, of course, the court has the inventory. It has to be returned to the court under Article 108. And say, I'm the owner, and have this evidence, the inventory receipt. And I'm entitled to request that the court return the money. And we don't concede that that only happens at the end of the case, as counsel represented. In fact, in the district court, it was the case, plaintiff's counsel did say that a logical endpoint for the detention of cash that's held for investigation or evidence, which is true of both classes here, is at the end of the criminal proceeding. But it doesn't mean it can't be raised earlier, at the arraignment even, under Article 108. I believe the section is Section 108.11.
So it's just a motion for return of property, effectively?
Correct, effectively.
And what's the city's home rule argument here? I thought the city was also making an argument that it had some independent interest in the retention of this property that would trump... just as in the Jowden case, I guess, where there were two different jurisdictions asserting some authority over the assets, and thus just because one jurisdiction was willing to give up its claim, the other wasn't.
Your Honor, the city has not exercised home rule authority with respect to the inventorying and detention of, or inventory and return, excuse me, of seized cash. That's governed by Article 108. And the police proceed pursuant to Article 108 to seize potential evidence, something that might have been derived from the crime or the fruits of the evidence are used in the crime, and that's the basis for holding it until it's been determined that it really isn't needed for investigation or evidence. So there's no conflict between there is a statute, or excuse me, an ordinance that says that upon official notification, with 30 days passed without it being claimed, then it can be disposed of according to law.
See, and that worries me. Again, if somebody's sitting in the jail, 30 days can slip by without any trouble. And then I guess the city just says, oh, you're too late. We're keeping the money. They obviously keep a lot of money.
Well, as to narcotics arrestees, at least, there's evidence in the record that the city will give an extension of the time to reclaim funds if the arrestee makes an inquiry about their money. And
of course, on the narcotics arrestees, I mean, I have some issues about the way the city has briefed the notice issue that your opponents have raised, and the question whether you need to take a look at the Cook County Sheriff's webpage to see who's in prison, because you cite, as you should, the Mullane against Central Hanover Bank case. But recall the facts in Mullane. In Mullane, the bank was using notice by publication when it had names and addresses available to it, and the Supreme Court puts the burden on the bank to follow up with that information which is reasonably available to it. Now, I would think the subset of people in the city of Chicago, I'll say, who are actually arrested by the police and who get these inventory people is a subset for whom a reasonable step would be to take a look at the website of the Cook County Sheriff to see if that's where the notice is. I don't think under Mullane you'd have to go any further than that. You're only supposed to use information that's reasonably available to you, but surely that is.
I think Mullane is distinguishable because there it was really a question of notice by publication versus personal notice versus mailing notice. And there's an address. There's no...
Well, think of Eisen. Again, the court says you've got to use the names and addresses available to you, even if it's expensive, even if it's a pain in the neck. I mean, that was the holding of Eisen. Mullane, and it relies in part on Mullane. It's hard for me to see that one step, or even that one step, when an envelope is returned as unclaimed, you think, oh, you know, maybe the reason he didn't get it is because he's in our custody. It's not like he's in some foreign jurisdiction's custody. He's here in Cook County in the jail.
Well,
it's hard to see why that's not, why due process and efforts at reasonable notice don't require a reasonable effort to find out where the person can be found.
Well, the address is taken from the inventory receipt, which is
exactly, and the person has been arrested, and so there's an address on the inventory receipt. According to your opponents, all you have to do is type in the name, you know, Elton Gates, and it would pop up on the Cook County jail site whether Elton Gates is in the Cook County jail or not. Yes or no? That's an extra minute. I don't disagree with you that there is some burden there. But you've got to send the notices out anyway. And I'm concerned about your reading of Mullane to think that you have absolutely no obligation to use information that's readily at hand.
Well, the, part of the problem is that the search on the sheriff's website would only be as reliable as the information that's on it. And the sheriff expressly disclaims.
And you don't have any need to go beyond that. Nobody's saying you've got to send people door to door in the city of Chicago and say, have you found Mr. Gates? It's the use of information reasonably available. So I don't think there's any question that if it doesn't come up, it doesn't come up. And you say, we did everything we reasonably could.
Well,
maybe he's off on a writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum, you know, to some other jurisdiction. Fine. You know, he's not in your custody.
The other point is, CPD doesn't really know why, nobody could know, why notices of return are delivered. It could be that a false address was given at the time.
They don't have to know. I'm just saying, again, you're going from what you do to the perfect, and I'm just going from what you do to the reasonable effort, which is probably short of the perfect. I completely agree with you that there would be people you didn't find, but I suspect you'd find a lot more. Or at least that's what your opponent's hypothesis is.
It is. They haven't really shown either that just because an arrestee is incarcerated that they wouldn't receive a notice mailed to their residence. I mean, people do get, it could be an occupant, a current occupant in the residence. There could be, they give power of attorney to individual to take their mail and do what's necessary.
Yeah, but there are cases in other areas that do require notification of people actually in the institution where they're incarcerated. Not everybody has an extended family who's going to pick up the notice and take it into them.
That's correct. Well, I believe those cases involve situations where the government has actual knowledge that the...
Right, but what's actual knowledge? The sheriff of Cook County has actual knowledge of who's in the jail.
But the city does not.
But it's a public website. You could find out. Actually, I've been stunned. I mean, if you're wondering which prison in Illinois some prisoner's in, you can just go into the website and find out.
Well, I guess just under settled authority, mailing the notice to the last known address is adequate.
And I'm just questioning, what's the last, is this really the last known address when the last action was to turn the person over to the custody of the sheriff of Cook County? Is this really the last known address?
As far as CPD knows, without looking further, an inquiry that we believe is not required under the settled case law, then...
Well, we'll see.
The procedure under 108 for going to court, there's some argument about home rule again, and I think Judge Wood mentioned it. What is a procedure for under 108? Which court do you go to?
You go to the criminal court where the arrestee is arraigned and where the criminal proceeding occurs.
What about divisional courts, rather than just, I mean, there's more than just one criminal court facility in Cook County, isn't there?
Correct. I think it would be wherever the criminal case is brought, if one is brought. See that my time is up.
I'm going to give you two more minutes as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. The The Article 108 remedy is available in the criminal proceeding itself. So that
what about the conflict in evidence? I mean, I know the city introduced these 10 cases where actual orders were made, and then there was evidence on the plaintiff's side that, you know, in 20 years they hadn't seen an order like this. And it seems to me that there's a conflict in the actual availability of this remedy.
Well, I think the first problem with the affidavits that plaintiffs submitted is that the question of whether Article 108 is an adequate remedy is really, it's almost certainly one of law. We didn't find case law that addresses that specifically in this context. But in assessing the adequacy of a state law remedy in a context like under Peratt, it is a question of law. So there's really no need to take evidence. It also seems that these sweeping statements by the affiants cannot be based on personal knowledge. It's just not possible. And they're flawed for that reason as well. If there are no further questions, we ask that the district court's judgment for the city be affirmed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Powell. Mr. Peters, you have 2 more minutes.
Thank you very much for the additional 2 minutes. I appreciate it. First, Your Honor, if I may go back to the question that you just asked counsel. Section 108 is not an effective remedy for the reasons that I previously stated, which is that while the criminal case is pending, the criminal court judge is either not going to enter the order because, in theory, and all of the cases that the city cites involve this theory, the property might be used as evidence, even though it's been commingled. Therefore, they don't return they don't enter these orders until the end of the criminal case, which is too late. That is not a prompt hearing. Even if that particular rule did not apply, the Jaudan case indicates that as long as there's a possibility of a forfeiture action being filed, and it doesn't have to be by the city, it could be by the federal government, by the county, or by the state of Illinois, then there is concurrent jurisdiction, and the criminal court judge cannot enter the order. It's prohibited by Jaudan, and if they did enter the order, the city wouldn't have to follow it. And finally, with respect to the reference to Section 108 at the bottom of the right column of the inventory receipt, the problem with that reference is above it is the language that Judge Wood has been focusing on concerning go here, and then the plausible, most sensible reading of that of those instructions are that once you go to the police station, you will eventually get an official notification. Instead of considering that is misleading, the district court applied an irrebuttable presumption that if there is any state remedy that could conceivably help you, that no matter how misleading this inventory receipt is, you're bound to know and follow that state remedy. That is not the law. Adkins doesn't say that. West Covina doesn't say that. Those cases involve situations where the statutory remedy was not in doubt and the notice was not confusing. If the notice is confusing or misleading, then at the very least there's a question of fact that has to be resolved. Was the presumption rebutted or was it not? So for all of these reasons, the court should reverse. Thank you.
Thank you.